Hello, listeners. My name is Alexander Pena. I'm a doctoral candidate in medieval studies at Yale, and I'm here to introduce and interview Dr. Nuria de Castilla as part of the Iberian Connection series, so wonderfully organized by Dr. Jesus Velasco. Nuria de Castilla is professor of history and codicology of the manuscript book in the Islamicate world at the École Pratique des Hautes Études in Paris. Her main research topics are the history of the Arabic manuscript book, codicology, history of libraries, Islamo-Christian relations in the early modern period, Alhamiya, the literature and production, and the transmission of Quranic manuscripts in the Islamic West. She's been lecturing at the Complutense University in Madrid, at the Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona, the École Pratique des Hautes Études in Paris, Warburg Institute in London, and Carleton University in Ottawa. And she's also been invited as a visiting professor at the National Library of Israel in Jerusalem, the Biblioteca Ambrosiana in Milan, and the University of Boulder, Colorado, and Columbia University in New York. So Nuria, why don't you tell us a little bit about the work that you're currently doing?
Well, good morning, and first of all, thank you for inviting me to participate in this wonderful project. As you said, my current research project bears upon the Quran in the Iberian Peninsula in the late Middle Ages and the early modern period. This rich research is developed in a largest frame. It's in conversation with, it's in the frame of the production and transmission of the written culture of Islamic communities in Spain in this same period, the late Middle Ages and early modern period, that is to say 15th until 17th centuries. And in conversation with the Ottoman Empire, the history of the book in this part of the Mediterranean, the East, and with the South as well, with Maghreb tradition, and with the Christian communities in Europe as well in the same period. We cannot understand these communities, these Islamic communities in Spain, without understanding the context of this part of the world. Why this study about the Quran in the Quran in general and mainly in these communities? Both the text of the Quran and the object that contains it, namely the book, have had and continue to have special significance for believers, Muslims and not Muslims, and also for non-believers. And the text, well, all of us, we link the text of the Quran with a religious thought, rituals and prayers, but in the Middle Ages, it was also used by Muslims in a magic context and for pedagogical purposes as well. But it was used as well by Christian communities with other kind of uses. It was used to learn Arabic and also, or mainly, if I can say, to find the best way to fight against Islam. So I'm very interested in these different uses of the Quran, and the manuscripts can shed light about all these uses. I'm going to give you some examples. In some cases, the Quran was written to be read in one single place. So in that cases, we have big and heavy volumes, or it was written to be read in different places. And in those cases, we have smaller dimensions and the manuscripts with less decorations. These smaller volumes were primarily conceived with practical usage in mind. They were produced to be used in everyday in religious context, and they are regular copies without any kind of decorations nor polychromy, and they were practical copies produced to be read. So we can have these small volumes practical volumes to be read in religious contexts, but we have other kind of manuscripts, several Quranic copies that have come down to us, especially from the 14th century onwards, are also in small formats as the previous ones. However, they were simply produced as objects. And objects, what do I mean with objects? They were not so written, they were not intended to be read. They were not intended even to be opened, but they were, the object itself was important enough. It was used as a daily amulet, much in demand to go to war, and it's not needed to know Arabic, it's not needed to open it, but the object itself, it was very, very important. It was, it was used for that. So we can have it within a very, very small script. The decoration is not there either, but it was not intended to be used like that. And finally, I would like to show you or to speak about another kind of manuscripts which not need to be read, but they need to be open. And they are just artistic objects. They were copied to be admired for their aesthetic program. They are high quality copies, usually in big dimensions and very well decorated. And these manuscripts are not used in this religious context, in this magic context, but as they are part of private collections, or they are models for calligraphers or painters or manuscript decorators, and that they can be in Muslim communities or in Christian communities. So this is this different kind of uses in the as a consequence of the production transmission of the Quran in these communities, which I'm interested in and that I'm working with.
This is all really fascinating. So what, let's maybe gloss a couple of terms and talk a little bit about the language of the Quran itself, right? So who were the Mudéjares, who were the Moriscos, and what languages do we see them use in their Qurans? Because most of us would assume, right, the Quran would be written in Arabic, but some of the fascinating work that you're doing suggests otherwise or reveals otherwise.
Yeah, we have in this Quran, among the Mudéjar and Morisco communities, we have two languages, Arabic and Alhamiya, and two scripts, Latin script and Arabic script. So we have all this universe of languages and scripts, very, very natural or very common in that period among these communities. But I think I have, after studying a lot, the manuscript, the Quranic manuscripts produced by these communities, I think I can suggest a chronology of using these languages. Before the 15th century, I can say that the Arabic was the language used, because we haven't found any translation of the Quran. It doesn't mean that the translations were not produced, but we haven't kept any. So we have only manuscripts in Arabic script until the 15th century, produced in Islamic Spain. And the volumes contain the whole Quran, or in one single volume or in different volumes. In the contrary, from the beginning of the 16th century, after the first conversions, we start finding another kind of product. We then have these complete volumes of the whole Quran, in one single volume or in different volumes, but we start finding some excerpts of the Quran, some homogeneous selections of the Quran, what I've called the Morisco Quran. It's true, it's not a real Quran, because it doesn't contain the 114 surahs, but it's what they were copying. And these excerpts of the Quran, called as well, selection of the Qurans, we can find them in Arabic, only in Arabic, in translation, in interlinear translation or paragraph by paragraph translation, and also only in Alhamia in Arabic script or in Alhamia in Latin script, as is the example of the famous Quran of Toledo produced in 1604, not in Toledo.
And so what is this, what's Alhamia for listeners who might not be familiar with it? Alhamia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what? It's Romance language, right?
Yes, Alhamia is Romance language. Well, literally, it's the language spoken by the others. So in this case, the others are the Christians. So in this case, again, that means the Spanish language, but written in Arabic script. The other day, I was fascinated because in Africa, they have the same phenomenon called Ajami, so with the same root as this Alhamia. And someone wrote me from Nigeria asking me some bibliography about Alhamiado, about Alhamian. And well, for me, it was really very, very curious and a nice thing because we use the same name to call this language used by the others. But it's not exactly the same. So in this case of Mudéjares and Moriscos, it's a Spanish, sort of Spanish, very Arabized, and with a lot of Aragonesisms, and words from an old Spanish written in general in Arabic script, but in some cases as well in Latin scripts, and used by Mudéjares and Moriscos between the 15th and the beginning of the 17th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one of the aspects of the work that you're doing now in the history of the Quran, which I find so fascinating and so timely, is that you're tracing its fate both as a sacred text and a scripture, but also as a physical object within vastly different but contemporaneous and interconnected worlds. Right, so on the one hand, you have these Morisco communities, which were under violent attack in the 15th and 16th centuries, and the other is the elite world of the imperial Christian court, right, which might obtain these objects, these Quranic objects, the manuscripts themselves, and other Islamic religious texts. So these religious texts, they emerge as both a lifeline for the communities trying to preserve that heritage but are under attack, as well as cultural artifacts which were sought for both destruction and preservation by the Christians that they came across. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about the history of the Moriscos themselves, who they were, what might have led them to produce these Qurans in different languages, so whether Alhamiado or Arabic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you know, the history of Spain in this period is a very amazing history, an amazing moment, is very contradictory. Until, well, in 1492, Granada is kept by Christian, the Catholic kings, because until that moment, all the kingdom of Granada was under Muslim rulers. From that moment on, Spain, the Iberian Peninsula, was Catholic, but the Muslims could stay there with their rules, with their music, with their language, with their religion. So no problem at all, or at least it was agreed by the Catholic kings with the king of Granada. However, at the end of the 15th century, things started to change. And well, the first thing was at the beginning of the 16th century, in 1502, the first forced conversion started. So the Moriscos were obliged, well, the Mudéjares, that was the name, had the Muslim communities under the Christian rulers, they were forced to convert to Catholicism. And so since that moment on, they started to be called convertidos de Moriscos, or new Christians. And then the historiography started to call them Moriscos. So this was the first prohibition, the religion. They needed to change the religion, but it was only the first prohibition. since then on, the process of acculturation starting, and they started to, it was forbidden for them to slaughter the animals in the way they used to have their parties, to use their customs, to continue with their cultural practices. And then in the 60s of the 16th century, they were forbidden to use language, Arabic language, written and oral language. So in 1568, the Revuelta de las Alpujarras, the Alpujarras revolt, started because, they couldn't stand up with all these prohibitions. So this is the situation. All the manuscripts linked with the religion were forbidden. It was completely impossible because, they couldn't be Muslim anymore. And so the Quranic manuscripts or all other manuscripts related to the Islamic religion were forbidden. However, at the same time, in the collection of the Philip II in L'Escorial, in the second part of the 16th century, they have a manuscript, they have Arabic manuscripts, and among others, they have Quranic manuscripts. They, at the beginning of the 17th century, the library of the Sultan of Morocco, Moulay Zaidan, arrived to Spain, and we have now in the L'Escorial Library the famous Quran of Moulay Zaidan, copied in 1599, and it's there, and it was part of the collection of Philip III, and it was close to other manuscripts, and at the same time they were burning manuscripts not only in Granada but in other places, and they were taking manuscripts from all these communities. As you know, Clenard, the Belgian bibliophile, came to Spain in order to learn Arabic, and with the idea of finding Arabic manuscripts, because, it's normal for Orientalists or for scholars at that moment in the 16th century, is where is the best place to find Arabic manuscripts rather than in Spain. But when he arrived to Spain, he realized that there was no Arabic manuscripts. And they were forbidden, and no manuscripts were there, but in some cases we could find them in the royal collections, exactly, but they were not affordable for the rest of the people.
Right, so this is a really interesting sort of paradox, right? So we have bibliophiles looking for Quranic manuscripts or other Arabic manuscripts at the same time that they've been eliminated, or they're trying to be eliminated in Spain. So I'd actually like to talk a bit comparatively about this ambivalent history of the Quran in Western or Latin Europe between the Middle Ages and the early modern period, since your expertise straddles both the Middle Ages and early modernity. And this is a divide which often sharply demarcates academic discussions. So in the period that I'm working on, for example, in the 12th and 13th centuries, we see ecclesiastics, clerics, people in the church develop a very deep intellectual commitment to the study of the Quran. So people like Peter the Venerable, the Abbot of Cluny in the 12th century, or Rodrigo Jiménez de Rada, who was the Archbishop of Toledo in the 13th century, actually commissioned the Quran to be translated from Arabic into Latin, right? And a lot of clerics, especially associated with the mendicant orders, like the Dominicans, actually learn Arabic to read the Quran in its original language. So there's big ecclesiastical interest in attaining this knowledge. But what changes in our period? Now, who's interested in the Quran? Why aren't ecclesiastics interested in it in Spain any longer, or interested in preserving it?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Exactly. In Middle Ages, the ecclesiastics were the people most interested in the Quran. And in the 16th century in Spain as well, we have in Salamanca University, they were teaching Arabic, and the ecclesiastics were the the students of or the people who were there to speak or to learn Arabic. When I was working on that topic, I realized that they were not using the Quran to learn Arabic, but they were using the Evangelists to learn Arabic. But the purpose was the same. They needed to learn Arabic in order to convert Muslims. I think we have different ways to convert Muslims, but they think the purpose was always the same from the Middle Ages until the modern period, was to convert. We have people as Juan de Segovia or Nicolás de Cusa, who preferred to be in dialogue with Muslims, but other people, as centuries before, as Robert of Ketan, who preferred another kind of translation or another kind of approach.
Right.
It was he was not very scientific, but at the same time, his translation was the most used translation we have in Latin until the Renaissance as well. No? So, there are two traditions, but I think the purpose is the same, is to convert the other. The other can be shown as the enemy or not, but is the Christian religion or the Catholic religion the good one? And we have, the Catholics need to be sure that the non-Catholics started to take the best way or the proper way to go to the paradise, the religious and spiritual paradise, not to the material paradise.
All right, thank you. So this, I think, might actually bring us into a discussion about Islamophilia and Islamophobia more generally, and maybe comparing the evolution of these two phenomena between the Middle Ages and the early modern period, right? So in the Middle Ages, we do see kings adopt or express a deep interest or even love for Islamic artifacts, Islamic architecture, or art, or objects, or knowledge, scientific knowledge, philosophical knowledge. What do we see in the 15th century? In one of your works, you discuss the contrast between Charles V, the emperor in Spain, building his palace in the Alhambra, which is the most iconic example of Islamic architecture in Spain, at the same time that we see these persecutions and inquisitions going on. So I was wondering whether you could tell us a bit about your thoughts on this ambivalence.
Yeah, again, we find the paradox of history of Spain. And I think it's a political explanation. And in another way, as it happens today with other communities, not only Islamic communities, because the others, it depends on the experience of everyone in a single moment, and this interpretation can change depending on different things. For example, in the Spanish, we have a lot of bibliography about that, Islamophobia and Islamophilia, and mainly concerning this golden age literature, for example, 16th, 17th century Spanish literature. And we have in Cervantes or Quevedo or Lope de Vega, we can have different points of view about these Muslim communities, which can allow us to know more about how Spanish people or how Christian communities perceive these Islamic communities in Spain. But how can we speak about Spain as a country or different kingdoms? Or even now, how can speak about the point how North American people see the Islamic communities? Well, it depends. It depends on every single person, it depends on the moment, it's after or before one single event that happened in the 11th September, or And it depends on our specific experience. So to speak about how in Golden Age the Muslim communities were perceived by others is really very difficult. It depends. And in Granada, well, it depends on perceived by who? By Christians or even by other Islamic communities as well. You know that after the Alpujarra revolt, 1568, one of the things that the Islamic communities in living in Granada were obliged to leave this area and to go to Castile. In Castile, there was a very big community of people, of Islamic people there, and they were the first ones who decided not to accept the Muslim communities or the Muslim people coming from Granada. Because they didn't want to be to be associated with them. Right. It's like no, now we are completely acculturated. Well, we are Christian. We are we don't know what exactly, but we are living here, very good in Toledo or well in this Castile region, and we don't want that other people coming from other areas, even if they have our same religion, we don't want them to come here and to start having problems with the Christian authorities. So I think it's a very important, but at the same time, very difficult topic to answer in 2 minutes. And right. But it deserves to a longer meeting and even a workshop or something just to identify how these communities were perceived, and even now how do we perceive the other or the others, not, and who are the limits between you and I, between them and we, between and us, or which are these frontiers, and how the medias nowadays, and how the world university, and how the establishment lead us to perceive or to think something or one specific thing or another one. But I think it would be worthy to speak more about that in another occasion.
Thank you, that was a beautiful, beautiful discussion. I thought last minute, we could actually talk about the physical object, the codicology of these Quranic manuscripts. So some questions that I had were about your thoughts on sort of bilingual manuscripts or manuscripts with different languages, what might have the social uses been of those manuscripts. And also comparing, what can you tell us about differences between these manuscripts and Latin or Romance manuscripts that medievalists or early modernists studying Europe might be more familiar with?
I've been working in ecology for a long time, but still there's a lot to do because in the written culture by Mudéjares and Moriscos, it's very interesting because they are in the middle of two cultures, the Christian culture or the Spanish Christian culture and the Islamic Maghrebi culture. And they know both. And they are, it's like in languages, they are in the middle of both languages, in the middle of both scripts, and in the middle of the two different book traditions. And so in some aspects they knew the some copyists, skilled people knew perfectly the Maghrebi and the Islamic tradition of the book, but they were aware of the Christian book culture as well, present in Spain at that moment. For example, well, in a very, very material aspect, in Islam, the choir, the number of folios in every choir is 10, but in Spain, in the 16th century, is 12, so Sinian. And we have a lot of manuscripts, some Marisco manuscripts, where we find this kind of choir, but this is a very small thing. But for me, when I found it, I said, they are copying this kind of tradition, and it's normal. But for example, in how they wrote, I think it's more interesting. In 16th century Spanish, we have some words grouped. For example, the syntagms, preposition, article, noun, and they are written all together. And what they do in Arabic script is the same thing. So they grouped these words, copying the way to do in Spanish, regular Spanish literature written by Christians. Or at the end of the word, when in Arabic it's forbidden, there's a rule which forbids to cut the words, for example. But what Moriscos do is to cut the words at the end of the paragraph without any kind of problem. And in general, not in all cases, it depends on if the copyist was skilled or not, or if he knew more or less the language, of course. But in several cases, we find that at the end of the paragraph, the words were cut in a syllabical way. So it's like just copying what they were doing in the Christian Spanish tradition. And so there are some specific features that we know that they were worried about that culture, and of course the contents. We have some passages written, I don't know, by Lope de Vega or Góngora or Garcilaso de la Vega, written in Arabic script or written in this frame of Morisco literature, but they were as well copying things like Los Amores de París y Viana or Los Dichos de los Siete Sabios de Grecia. It's a very, very well-known pieces or works in Europe, and they were copying them in Arabic script. And so for me, it's like we cannot keep saying that Morisco communities were completely isolated, that they were not, they did not know anything, that they did not didn't know Arabic, and they didn't know the word of the Christian innovations. We have to stop to repeat that, because they were living there, and they were to the Plaza Mayor to the Corral de Comedias to see the plays, to see Lope de Vega plays. And they were there, and it was fun for them as well. And of course they were aware, they could read, and they were in touch with the neighbors. And so I think it's a very important thing, not to forget that Christian communities, they were as illiterate as Moriscos were, 16th century Spain, and two, that both communities were living together in a way, so we cannot don't have to mix the political or the official religious point of view and the reality, and so that the manuscripts can show us a lot of things about this common reality, about languages, about cultures, about histories of the book, about communication between these two communities. So, yes, we have to study more about manuscripts and about these communities.
All right, thank you so much for a wonderful discussion. It's been wonderful having you and interviewing you.
Thank you very much.